And before joining the University of Washington, he worked as a postdoctoral associate at MIT from 2002 to 2005 and held an assistant professor positions in the Department of Geosciences in the School of Natural Resources and Biological Systems Engineering at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And he has a BS and MS in Agricultural Engineering from Turkey and a PhD in Civil and Environmental Engineering from Utah State. And his research is highly interdisciplinary and aims to understand the role of climate on eco-hydrological and geomorphical response of landscapes, sediment transport, and the water balance of large basins. And today, he's going to tell us about landscape system responses under changing climate.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Can everybody hear me well back there? I have the power to control here. Okay, so I had to think really hard about what to talk today because a lot of my research is in the Southwest and in the Midwest, and so I try to choose something that's relevant for this part of the country. So what I'll talk about is I'll start with a general slide about how we manage our resources. So if you're a resource manager. Or maybe more specifically, a water manager, in my case, I have to satisfy different needs of the community. Let's say the clean water, I have to have the clean water. I've planned for it. We have to have the ecosystem needs satisfied in the meantime to maintain the sort of the natural behavior of the system. We have to manage the natural hazards. If there's irrigation, then we have to have some water for that irrigation, but in the meantime, we have to sort of satisfy the other needs as well. So what happens is that if you are a resource manager, water manager, you have to really understand the engine behind this. That's nature, right? You have to either use some empirical laws, equation, or more fundamental laws, models, to be able to do some predictions about what you're managing and what the consequences of that management might be. But the complex picture of it, I mean, nature is complex of its own, but there's the climate that is highly variable in space and time. Now, there's the climate change as well that makes things really difficult to understand and manage. So we have to be able to understand these linkages first to be able to make these decisions. But on the other hand, when you make the decisions, let's say you're managing the ecosystem, you cut the forest and things like that, then it has a feedback on the nature itself, which could also impact your decision-making process. So what I'll talk about is more from an ecosystem management perspective here, and I'll deal with more forest fires to sort of make that connection with the nature. So when we look at forest fires, what causes forest fires? We have some of the causes are accumulation of biomass, dry plant residue on the soil, dry soil conditions, high temperatures, obviously important, and some ignition lighting. And if you look at the probability or percentages of the forest fires with respect to different months, obviously because of the high temperatures and dry soil conditions, dry vegetation conditions, there's the high risk of forest fires in months of July and August in the northern United States, the Southwest as well. And that's logical. So if you look at our temperatures, so the temperatures is an important component, this slide looks at shows the impact of temperature and snow melt on the frequency of forest fires from Westerling et al. So this is plotting the number of forest fires, and that's the annual temperature over the West. And this plot shows the snow melt anomalies. If it's a positive number, it's a late snow melt. Negative number means an early snow melt. Early snow melt obviously means higher temperature. So if you look at, for example, 1975, there's only a few forest fires. The snow melt was late, and the temperatures was low. If you look at here, in 1980s to 1995, you have high temperatures, early snow melt and a lot of forest fires. So you can immediately see the linkages between climate and forest fires. So what is the outlook with climate change? How things are going to, we expect things to change? So this is looking at from, quoting from Salath et al. In 2009. This is a report from the Climate Impacts Group. They run two different models looking at the temperatures in the West and showing the temperatures winter, spring, summer, and fall temperatures here in one model output. This is another model output. And this is only showing the changes, positive changes, from the mean temperatures from 1970s to 2000. And all the changes are positive. And of course, you're saying that the summers in both models are much darker, meaning that there's a significant increase in temperatures in the years to come. And this is looking at the snow water equivalents with the same model output, quoting from Eric's Climate Impacts Group report again. And this is showing us the percent changes in snow water equivalents in April 1. So this is the historical data, and this is the future in the next 100 years. As you can see, there is less snow water equivalents, meaning that higher temperatures, less snow water equivalents. That has to say something about forest fires in this region. This is another part of that Climate Impacts Group assessment report from Little et al. And they looked at, with this climate model scenarios, they looked at the increase in area burned in the model world. So this box shows us the historical area burned, statistics of that, and the two different climate model simulations in until 2020, 2040s, and 2080s, as you can see, there's always increase in the area burned. So what should we expect with this increase in area burn? So what will be the consequences on hydrology, sediment transport, water, etc., in this region or in a forested basin in general? So now let's take a look at the impacts of wildfires on some of the watershed processes. Obviously, the watershed feels that forest fire through hydrology first. What is critically important is that, of course, you're losing the canopy, you're losing the plant. That's one thing. And another thing is that there's the decrease in infiltration capacities on the surface. There's so-called the water repellency on the soil surface, which doesn't allow infiltration. So there's direct runoff generation from that surface after burn. This doesn't happen in all forest fires, but if the fire is intense enough, if the conditions were dry, you have the water repellent conditions on the surface. So you have water repellency, much more runoff is generated on the surface. There is less infiltration, right? There's not much canopy, so everything sort of falls on the surface. There's more input, less infiltration, more runoff. And also, you're losing the root system. So evapotranspiration from the canopy and transpiration from the plant itself is much reduced. With that, you have perhaps changes in the way the runoff is generated on the surface, and this is very critical. Overall, we expect that for the most part in forested basins where you have snow melt and maybe a drizzling type of precipitation, you will expect a lot of infiltration into the soil that forms some sort of subsurface flow response. And you get runoff generated in the areas of convergence of topography. This is what we call the saturation excess overland flow. This was pioneered by Tom Dunn, who was a professor here at Washington, University of Washington. So when you change the system, so you you change the infiltration rates, with forest fire, more runoff, less infiltration. There's the runoff infiltration, excess runoff generation. Essentially, there's less infiltration. The subsurface flow response is not enough to develop the subsurface flow, but you have a lot of runoff generated that will have other consequences, significant consequences on the surface. So I'll just quote a few studies looking at the infiltration rates before and after fires. This paper, Shakespeare and Dorr, did a really good review looking at different field studies all over the U.S. This is plotting infiltration capacity on x-axis and number of studies in different places. This is before unburnt sites, and these are the burnt sites after forest fire. There's significant decrease in infiltration. This is also looking at Martin and Moody in 2001. They looked at some sites in New Mexico and Colorado. Yeah, you can see the difference in the burnt and unburnt. Unburnt is as high as tenfold larger than the unburnt, than the burnt sites, showing the impact on infiltration and runoff generation. So what happens? You lost the canopy. You have high infiltration rates. First thing that happens is that you have high rates of rain splash erosion. So rain detaches particles and makes them available for runoff transport on the surface. Not only rain detaches particles, it also clogs the pore surfaces. So you may actually decrease the infiltration capacity further with that. So with that detached rain, there's a lot of rain runoff generated because of decreased infiltration capacities. And you may see fluvial process like this. This is real erosion from a fire in Buffalo Creek fire in New Mexico. And this is some fluvial processes that I studied in Idaho. This all happened after forest fires. Forest fires has also impact on the landsliding issues. Obviously, because you're losing the root contact to the bedrock, you're losing the root cohesion. So this is looking at some forest post-fire landsliding in Italy. That's, landslides also happen in steep places. I mean, you don't necessarily need a forest fire to trigger them. Looking at some Switzerland landslides and landslides in China. And all related to sort of if you lose that root structure, that connection with the bedrock and the cohesion that the root structure provides, of course, this colluvium that has been accumulating over time could destabilize with that. So conceptually, when we have these forest fires, what do we expect to see on the surface? And is there any time associations between different sort of processes? Conceptually, this is a model output. Plotting time after fire, let's assume that here there was a fire at time zero. Let's assume that this fire caused some significant water repellency, and this is showing that this spike shows the fraction of the basin that's water repellent. Usually that water repellency would break in the next 3 years, 3 to 4 years, when the understory vegetation begins to come back. And with that, this is showing a surface vegetation roughness, that is roughness of the surface to overland flow, and the root cohesion all plotted in dimensionless terms. But immediately in the first maybe 5-6 years, when the water repellency is up there and when you have when the surface roughness is significantly low, you expect to see a lot of runoff erosion, surface runoff erosion due to those lower rates of infiltration capacity. Usually there is a delay in the root cohesion because the plant dies, you know, roots decay and those kinds of things. That has an impact sort of that delays the root cohesion response. And usually a lot of field studies show that the landsliding response would be between the year 10 and 20 or 30 is depending on what type of forest you have. So this is showing the conceptual diagram of that process. If you assume that you have the forest fire right at this time, immediately you are losing the vegetation on the surface, and then with the vegetation coming back in a few years, then you have this spike of sediment, fire-induced sediment yield from the basin. But also it's important to mention here that you will have some background sediment yields. I mean, those landscapes produce sediment because there's some creep, soil creep processes, there's bioturbation and things like that, that will always give you some background rates. So with the recent forest fires in the West, especially with the silvicultural practices that we have, and people often, managers often ask the question, how much of this is actually because of human impact? I mean, when we manage the forest, do we have a larger peak of this sediment? Or will we have a smaller peak of this sediment right over the forest fires? Or when we manage the forest, do we have more forest fires or less forest fires? Type of arguments has been very common in the last 20 years or maybe more. So through the so we have important questions for future management decisions, and some of them are: what will happen under climate change with increased fire frequency and earlier snow melts? So how can we forecast that over time? And what is the role of humans, forest roads, timber harvest, and etc., in modulating that response? So what is the impact of humans? What is our footprint on that process? And what are the objective criteria to evaluate human impacts? This is also a very important thing. So how are you going to judge ourselves, whether we're doing right or wrong, and in comparisons to what? So one way to look at these things is to do numerical modeling, and it's probably an easier way to do it. As engineers, we like models, I guess, more than data, or maybe I like it. So this is an example that I had to go back to my PhD to get anything meaningful here today. And so this research that I've done was published in three different papers in 2001 to 2003 in Water Resources Research and Journal of Geophysical Research. So in this work, we looked at the impacts of forest fires in the Idaho batholith. So this region is the granitic bedrock type. It's a steep landscape, forested V-shaped valleys. There's episodic stench replacing wildfires, very common in this region. And there's also high intensity, short duration summer thunderstorms. There's two different sort of dominant forms of hydrology: snow melt, rain on snow conditions, and the thunderstorms in the summer. And these thunderstorms could really generate high intensities, as high as 80 millimeters per hour, that has a return interval of one in 4 years. So that's significant rain. This region was looking at here that this was a North Fork of the Boise River. The region was burned in 1995. It was a very intense fire, especially in this basin. And then these gullies were generated in a couple years right after the fire. And there was some landsliding following gullies in different basins. So the basin on the right was intensely burned. Everything was gone on this basin like this. This is after 5 years, five years after that fire. So the surface vegetation came back, some shrubby type of vegetation, but still the trees are in the process of decay. The recovery hasn't started significantly yet. So this is the in this basin, there has been really significant gullies, and we looked at the location of gully hats right at the where they started first. And they went all the way to the hilltops. So essentially, everything was gullied. You have a question?
Are they gullying in pre-existing channels, or is it new gullies at the point?
Well, the gully, the sort of channel head, was extended all the way to the hilltop. Of course, you can imagine that this is a valley, okay? So this is, you can sort of reconstruct the shape of this valley. And this new gully was incised right following that forest, and the channel had hiked all the way up to even non-converging, even diverging areas of the landscape. And in a light burn landscape right next to it, there has been some channelization activity, but it only advanced the channel head. There was not significant incisions under the similar type of rainfall regime. So the question is that how large was this event? And this was a managed watershed through silvicultural practices. And how does it compare with the past events? And are we doing anything bad in our management practices, and how do we judge that? That's the question that we're going to look at. So in this region, this plot is showing sediment yields, tons over square kilometer, with basin area for different basins. Okay, and I'm showing three regimes of sediment. Let's look at the smaller yields. These are short-term averages. This data was compiled by Kirshner et al., published in 2001. So you can think about this as background rates when there's no forest fires and things like that. And these are, right in the middle, are long-term averages over maybe larger than 10,000 years. So this is the 10,000-year average sediment yield that comes from these basins in Idaho. And when we look at these guys up there, these are the gullies that were incised with that 1995 fires. So we looked at different locations, different landslides and gully initiation events. There has been other efforts going on in the area, so I plotted all that as a function of area. So this is the basin area. This is how much sediment that basin area generated. As you can see, there's a significant mismatch in this, right? You have these events are so large. I mean, with that one event, there is hundreds, orders of magnitude larger sediment coming with respect to the over day-to-day sediment yields. So where do we fit in this picture? So we developed a model. The model is forced by a climate. There is forest disturbances by wildfires and harvest. So when you disturb forest, of course, there's that impact on root cohesion, the water repellence of the surface that will alter the infiltration capacity. There's the surface roughness. This is the roughness for overland flow, to calculate overland flow velocity and shear stress type of ideas. And there is this soil development on the surface, and this is a very critical component because bedrock through weathering, bedrock develops soils, colluvium, right, and which are then subject to landsliding through initiation of landslides and debris flows and fluvial processes, which then contribute back to sediment yields. Usually, landslides are initiated by winter, spring, snowmelt type of hydrology. This is supposed to be summer thunderstorm type of events that feed the fluvial processes. So in this model construct, we have to evolve the soil depth, soil thickness on the landscape, and we're using digital elevation models for that. Okay, so the rate of change in the soil thickness is a function of a source term, which is weathering, so that develops the surface. This is sort of a conceptually showing that. There's weathering of bedrock that produces colluvium, and then there is the soil creep impact. That creeping soil converges into the hollow or diverges from the hollow. That changes the depth thickness of the colluvium. There's fluvial processes. If there is erosion, of course, it takes it from this. And there's the landsliding. I just represented in very simple forms, and sort of this shows the divergence of any flux. Okay. So this is the process that we change the soil thicknesses on the surface. The model was forced by stochastic weather events, just by looking at the historical precipitation and snowmelt events in this region, so I'm not going to get into that. But the model essentially not uses real data, but it generates the weather itself, because we're looking at long time scales. And there's some models that get into that. There's some probabilistic arguments in generating the channel initiation probabilities. This is some data showing the probabilistic argument in channel initiation. I'm not going to get into any details of that. But there's some field validation in both the initiation of any channels, initiation of any landslides on the surface, as well as the transport of the sediment, because we had a lot of gullies that we studied. This is plotting sort of an index of sediment yield from a gully as a function of an index of shear stress that might be observed in this along gullies. And this is a map sort of the plotting the sediment transport capacity on the landscape. So we have some reasonable observation on the landscape and validation of the model. And in the landslide component, for those of you who are familiar with this, we use the infinite plane slope stability model. It has the cohesion terms in it. If you have roots, you have cohesion. It increases the factor of safety. The landscape becomes more safe for landsliding. And there's some hydrology components that deals with the pore pressures and things like that. And this is how debris flow is generated in the model world. There's a landslide, let's say, initiated at this point on the landscape, and it sort of scars the sediment and deposits it in the channel in the model. There's some runoff generation processes. Let's skip these model equations. But there's some reasonable sort of dynamics in the model that we put in. This is showing an example of impacts of series of forest fires. By plotting over 500 years of simulation years, by plotting the basin average soil depth, so this is the soil, how much soil depth you have in the entire basin. That's the mean of it, okay? Normalized to a number, just to be able to plot them in an undimensional fashion. So when you have forest fire, this is plotting the root cohesion. So you have forest fire right up there, and then there's decay of root cohesion, and the forest grows back again. There's another fire. You know, these things continue over time. And this is the sediment yield that's getting out of the basin, sediment flux out of the basin. You can see that sort of when you have a couple of fires, you have a much different response than some of these little fires. And the response is not necessarily in relation to the fires, but it's usually how many, the frequency of fires and things like that. So when you have a model, first you have to understand what the model is doing. So if we get anything meaningful out of the model, what is the sensitivity of the model for different types of vegetation and things like that. So if we did some sensitivity analysis using different root cohesions representing different types of forests. So the larger root cohesion will be like the forest that penetrates into the bedrock and perhaps maybe have a more cohesion on the soil. And we forced the model with Idaho bathymetric type of climate and with forest fire ignitions of every 200 years. So on average, there's going to be one fire in every 200 years over that domain. And there's no timber harvest and things like that. So we run the model for 10,000 years and look at the cumulative distributions of sediment yields and the time between storms just to understand the impact of root cohesion over 10,000 years of time scales. This is an interesting plot. If you look at the low root cohesion, this is the cumulative distribution for low root cohesion, and this is the cumulative distribution for the highest root cohesion that we use. That's probably correspond to something like Douglas fir. What do you see in this? So if you take the mean of this distribution, you have a much larger mean of sediment yields per event than the low root cohesion. That means that when you have a denser forests, taller trees with higher root cohesion, the size of the landslides increase, and they become less frequent. Any ideas what may that cause that? So you have taller trees, more root cohesion, larger landslides, and less frequent. While the taller trees, you have higher root cohesion, it holds the soil. And over time, soil develops from the weathering of bedrock, and soil accumulates. When soil accumulates, of course, it has its own weight, and it will have produce some landsliding at some point. It will destabilize over steep slopes. But when it destabilizes, it already accumulated a lot of thickness, so it causes a much significant response. So that delay is caused by the increase in the root cohesion in this model. In a smaller part of this area, we looked at, okay, with these different root cohesions of forests, what is the extent of landsliding and erosion? So you're looking at the contour lines of this forest, of this topography, and this is high root cohesion, this is lower root cohesion this way. When you have high root cohesion, looks like only the large landslides is, at least for that 10,000 years, occur in the hollows where you have a lot of moisture accumulating. As you decrease your root cohesion, the channels went up to the hilltops. So I'm just skip this. And then we put the forest fire into the simulation. The first simulation was without forest fires. And plotting, looking at the same extent of landsliding in the same type of root cohesion values. In comparison to the other map with the same root cohesion, when you have forest fires, the extent of erosion expands to the hilltops, to the hollows. And the reason for that is that you have some regular disturbances to the forest, and there's decay of root cohesion that comes back again. So the landscape experiences a range of root cohesion. That's why landslides could happen in a range of different places, but usually confined with the hollows, sort of the converging topography on the landscape. Usually they don't go all the way up under some realistic simulations. So we picked our best simulation that would represent the ideal batholith, and we plotted on the same plot the model results. So this line shows us the mean modeled long-term average sediment yield. It is not very difficult to calibrate the mean sediment yields because you put some weathering rate to it. And if you calibrate your model with the right weathering rate, that's how much you're going to get out of it if your model conserves mass over the topography. So I'm not really impressed with how much mean I can produce from the basin. But also, if you look at the modeled event sediment yield, so if you take all events one by one and plot them, I plotted the 8% quantile and the 95 quantile of those, and they sort of capture the within the range of the observations on this landscape. That tells me that the model can also, not only the mean, but can also preserve the variability of sediment yields on the topography. So now we have a reasonable model that can give us some reasonable magnitudes of landslides and things like that. And now our question is that, so based on this model, what we see that approximately 92% of the sediment yields is due to the low frequency and high magnitude episodic erosion events without any management. 92% of the time, the landscape is not eroding significantly. Only 8% of the time there is a large landslide, could be due to a forest fire or could be a natural phenomena, but only those are the times that the landscape is experiencing significant erosion. So the next question is that how might forest management alter this inherently episodic erosion rates? So what is critical here that we need to understand, the human time scale is different than the natural time scale. In nature, you're looking at 10,000 years. Yeah, 10,000 years is not a whole lot of time frame. I mean, if you look at the climate change arguments and its impact on geomorphic processes, it is just a smaller period. But if you look at the human timescale, we don't have 10,000 years to live and manage the landscape, so we have to look at smaller time frames. But within the context of the natural evolution over that 10,000 years, let's say. So now we have the same model. We have the model parameters and initial conditions and climate events that are set up. And then we take that, the same model parameters and the climate events, and apply to a natural disturbance regime and a harvest disturbance regime with a harvest model, a very simple harvest model. And this one is forced by a fire model. As disturbances. But in the harvest scenario, we said that, okay, we're going to manage so greatly that there's not going to be any fire. So we're going to do great fire management and silvicultural practices, and there's not going to be any chances of forest fires. And we do the comparisons for 100 years. We're no more dealing with 10,000 years. We have a management time frame of 50 years, 100 years. We're going to have to manage that time frame. And over that 100 years, there's three rotations are simulated for timber harvest. No, actually, the timber harvest length is taken 100 years, and three rotations are simulated. And the experiment is repeated 21 times. Actually, it was 20 times, but there was a glitch in the model, and I happened to have 21 times. So it wasn't intentional. So with this rotation, we're forcing the landscape with random climate events that's represented over the current climate. Now, one thing that's important and we have to pay attention to it is the initial conditions in a simulation like that. And soil, the colluvium depth on the landscape is an important initial condition that we cannot, we have to pay attention. That's because if you start with a thick colluvium, you're going to get landsliding no matter what. If you start with a small colluvium, you may not get landsliding, whether you manage the landscape or not. So we take the soil depths from a long-term simulation. So this is the 10,000-year simulation of the mean soil depth across the landscape. So we identify three outputs from this 10,000-year simulation. This simulation is outputting every year soil thicknesses and the forest density and things like that. We take that minimum soil thickness that will represent the sort of the minimum available soil thickness on the landscape that is available for sliding. We take an average and we take a maximum. And this one is just full of soil that's ready to go for landsliding. And this one, it has a sort of the shallower of the last 10,000 years. And run the models 21 times, repeated it, compile all the data, and statistically analyzed the human-managed and the natural landscape. Now, this is only one plot showing on the one component of it, looking at the sediment yields. So we have the statistical parameter here, mean 50, then 95% quantiles, and the harvested condition, natural condition, and long-term condition. Three comparisons. Harvest, meaning that you harvest the landscape, you manage the landscape properly, you don't allow any wildfires. The natural is that you don't do the management. It's almost like a comparative experiment. You don't manage it. It's all natural. And these are the long-term sediment yields over 10,000 years of simulation. So this is nature. This is also nature, but this is much shorter time scale. This is longer time scale. So by comparing these, I mean, you can even make a judgment whether nature is managing itself in a natural way. Oh, you know, that would represent the long-term conditions. So the harvesting case, what we see is that the size of the sediment per event actually decreases significantly when you have harvest. Okay, so you have smaller landslides under the case of harvest. But the problem is that they're more frequent in this simulation, in the model. They're more frequent but smaller. In the natural case, in the 300 years of simulation, they were much larger than that, this, but smaller than the long term. So if you let the system go over 10,000 years, you actually get larger landsliding events than what you could get over a 100-year period. But if you manage the system, you even get less of that, lesser than that, but with more frequencies. And this is plotting the cumulative distributions of sediment yields for the minimum initial condition case, average condition case, and the maximum condition case. There's, of course, some arguments could also be made based on the range of these probability distributions, but sort of the most important sort of the summary was that you have more significant landslides with management with smaller magnitudes. So in conclusion, our model results showed good correspondence with field observations of event sediment yields. That sort of made us believe that the modeling can be used for management purposes. Forest vegetation acts as an erosion threshold. You can sort of, that controls the expansion of the landslide, that controls the fluvial extent of the domain. Unburnt dense forests promote less frequent high magnitude erosion events. Forest fires lead to more frequent erosion with smaller magnitudes. If you compare a forest that is never burned, it actually produces you larger events. If you have forests that are naturally burned, the event sizes become less. But if you have a forest that is burned with forest fires, but at the same time subject to water repellency and things like that, the differences between unburned and the forest fires is that accelerated erosion periods, which actually I skipped that in the interest of time, is that you have a window of opportunity for landsliding and surface runoff erosion with forest fires. That makes and everything come all together at one time during that window. If you don't have forest fires, you don't have that specific window that things come together, but you have sort of a randomly landsliding happening here and there, not with significant sort of a time coherent time structure to it, but it's more distributed over time and space. That makes sort of a significant difference between the response of these two landscapes. And the initial soil colluvium depths really matter. If you have a forest that is full of colluvium, full of soil, and you start managing that forest, you will expect that you will have some significant impact on the landscape, on erosion rates. So it's important to understand, to assess how much colluvium there is on the landscapes using some techniques, either field studies or some sort of interpolation schemes or models before actually you managing the soils. And in a numerical paired watershed experiment, forest clear cutting was shown to cause a twofold increase in the number of erosion events in the Idaho Basin, in contrast to that geomorphic response appeared to be more severe under wildfire disturbances without any kind of forest harvest activity. So I purposely try to keep this 40 minutes, and I'm done here. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to.
No questions.
Would you expect it to have a bigger drop, accelerated drop in soil cohesion if they go and do salvage logging after a forest fire?
Right after forest fire?
Yeah, they go and salvage logging. Does the decay of the root masses possibly lead to a lot quicker drop in soil cohesion and more severe?
Could be, although I'm not a...
So
the question is, right after a forest fire, if there is salvage logging, right, would that increase the decay? Would that cause a faster decay of root cohesion? Right? So I would assume, I mean, I'm not an expert in forest vegetation, but I would assume so, because you remove the vegetation quickly. But on the other hand, the vegetation is dead anyway. So if you're not removing the roots, what causes the decay is, I believe, the death of the roots over time. But the overstory is dead already. It may. Any idea about this question among you? This is a good question, but I'm not an expert in forest. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is that sometimes we don't kill all the trees when you have a forest fire. And when you don't kill all the trees, of course, the impact of forest fire in root cohesion will not be as intense as what I was showing. So my assumption that all the trees are dead and then the cohesion goes to the bottom immediately. Of course, in that case, the results will be different. But we don't. I'm not sure how to do that in a numerical model. So one way to do it may be kill half of the biomass. So that's a good question. I do run for timber stretching.
But was fire suppression complete in that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you consider running the model again with some sort of interaction with fire and harvest, which is sort of what we see on the landscape?
I think that I should have done that. That my advisor also suggested me to do that 10 years ago, but somehow I managed to get out of there without doing it. So I think that has been a delay for the last 10 years.
You were talking about climate change at the beginning and the change of when the snow water equivalent, how much there is. So what effect do you think that's, is it just going to have an effect on when the forest fires occur, or is it also going to have an effect? You imply that it's going to be more frequent, but also it's going to move it up in the seasons, so like we showed when the forest fires occur throughout the year, and then the sticker in July and August, will it then move differently in the season, and what
so if I understand correctly, the question is what is the influence of snow water equivalence changes in the timing and spatial extent of forest fires and the severity of forest fires? I'm assuming there is some significant impact on that. But the problem is that I'm not sure if we have models to be able to completely model that behavior at this point. And there's a lot of, in forest fires model, there's also some ignition probabilities. And a lot of those probabilities has to be given to the model. And sometimes you have to calibrate those probabilities based on past observations. So for predicting the forest fire impacts into the future is not a trivial thing in the absence of any probabilities. Either you have to set the probabilities constant. But there's more complicated forest fires that are coming along. Thank you.